I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. Psychologists James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen were hired by the CIA to devise an interrogation program that the Senate Intelligence Committee called torture in a report released last week. Their work drew from a military survival training program known as SEER, Survival, Evasion, Resistance, Escape. The brutal treatment detailed in the Senate report was also based on psychological experiments that resulted in something called learned helplessness. So how did a program that taught captured American military personnel survive torture get re-engineered to try to extract information from al-Qaeda suspects? And we have two guests who have joined us on Radio Times. Colonel Stephen Kleinman is a former military interrogator, former head of the Air Force's Strategic Interrogation Program. He was senior interrogator in Panama, the first Gulf War, and Operation Iraqi Freedom, and has been an instructor in the Air Force Survival, Evasion, Resistance, Escape Training. And Stephen, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It is a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Also with us is Scott Shane. He reports on national security for the New York Times. Scott Shane, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me.
Let me begin with actually two clips. The first one is former Vice President Dick Cheney being interviewed by Chuck Todd this past weekend on some of these interrogation techniques. Let's give this a listen.
5% of the detainees, though, 25% turned out not to have, turned out to be innocent. They were.
So where are you going to draw the line, Chuck? How
well,
are you going to know?
You. Is that too high? Is that, you're okay with that margin for error?
I have no problem as long as we achieve our objective, and our objective is to get the guys who did 9/11, and it is to avoid another attack against the United States. I was prepared, and we did. We got the authorization from the president and authorization from the Justice Department to go forward to the program. It worked. It worked now for 13 years. Mm-hmm. We've avoided another mass casualty attack against the United States. We did capture bin Laden. We did capture an awful lot of the senior guys of al-Qaeda who were responsible for that attack on 9/11. I'd do it again in a minute.
Here's another point of view. This is Senator John McCain talking on Face the Nation with moderator Bob Schieffer, also from this past Sunday.
You can't claim that tying someone to the floor and have them freeze to death is not torture. You can't say 183 times someone is waterboarded. And by the way, on waterboarding, it began with the Spanish Inquisition. It was done during the Philippines War. We tried and hung Japanese war criminals for waterboarding Americans in World War II.
Let me begin with you, Colonel Kleinman, and I hate to sort of begin on a semantic question, but we saw two very different responses to what was in this Senate report. Are we talking about torture?
As what was detailed in the report,
yes.
There's absolutely no question by any standard. I mean, by any international standard, you know, the Convention on Torture that the United States was and is a signatory to. It's very clear. I mean, it really just talks about the application of severe, I believe it's physical and psychological pressures or pain in order to elicit information or confession from an individual. I mean, and to be, as Senator McCain just said, being chained to the floor, some things we saw, the extent of sleep deprivation, the extent of standing, the slapping, they talk about walking a man up and down hallway and they're beating him. Mm. Yeah, that is what the world calls torture. There's only a small group of people, and it seems like it's in this country, and the only people that their counterparts in that idea or people who buy into that are small groups of people in countries that we've always found to have very heinous policies.
Scott Shane, let me turn to you. And one of the things that Vice President Dick Cheney says, he says, you know, he had no problem with this as long as it achieved the objective. I guess the ends justifying the means. I'd just like your response to that.
Well, I think, I've been covering this for a long time as information has gradually come out over the years and the Senate report has added a good bit more. But you can kind of divide the debate into two sets of questions. On the one hand, there's this moral and legal question about whether torture should be permitted, these kinds of methods should be permitted. And then there's the competence and efficacy question. Does it work, as people sometimes ask? I mean, I think one of the things that is most striking about what comes from the Senate report and from reporting we've done over the years, is really the question of the competence of this program. As a couple of my colleagues wrote in the New York Times this week, elaborating on stuff that we'd really written some years ago, the choice of these psychologists who helped design this program and the choice of those methods was made with, it appears, less research than most people would use to, buy a new phone or choose a house painter. There was somebody had heard the name of one of these psychologists and said, hey, why don't we talk to him? And within a matter of a couple of days, they were actually using these methods. It turned out that these psychologists had never had any experience in the real world conducting interrogations. So, you know, it's remarkable that a country like ours could embark on such a momentous course, such an important course, such an important job, without sort of checking up on what works, what doesn't work, and what the moral and legal implications are.
And I want to pick up on that, but let me go back to you, Colonel Kleiman, because you have been an instructor at the Air Force Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape Training Program. This is this SEER program. What was that in response to? Where did that come from?
The SEER program in the United States is really a product of a couple major events. Number one, post-World War II, we saw the Soviet show trials where people were claiming to be CIA agents, I mean, really pretty much dooming themselves to a life in the gulag when, in fact, they weren't the agents that we'd recruited. And so there was concern that, wait a second, how could the Soviets force people to be so compliant? And then we had the experience in the Korean War, and then that was supplemented by our experience in the Vietnam War, where we had military people who were subjected to the most horrific treatment. And the idea was, how do we prepare them? At the survival school, at the Air Force Survival School, it's really guiding light. It's more than a motto, but its mission is to return with honor. The idea is to help people prepare to deal with the most trying of circumstances in an interrogation and a detention setting, and return with their honor intact, meaning be able to protect information to the best of their ability and not participate in the production of propaganda. But go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, and I guess being put through, you know, some pretty, if I can use the word, torturous interrogation techniques.
Yes, but this is, I'm glad you've raised this, because I think this is very important for your listeners to understand. With great respect for anybody who spent as much time in public service as former vice president has, I mean, I don't know him personally, and I'm assuming that he is very well-intentioned. But I would also have to say that I think he's playing very fast and loose with some of the facts. Like, for instance, when they say that how could the torture program, how could the CIA program be so bad when it's only what we did and continue to do with U.S. military personnel? Well, that is wholly inaccurate, because they use many of the same techniques, you know, the walling, the slapping, the punching, the sleep deprivation, but the extent and the force and the lack of safeguards that were readily apparent in the CIA program, it's a completely different world. It's a completely different impact. It's it goes from training, because the idea in SEER, you take somebody to the edge of failure. We don't want to teach them how to fail. You teach them to the edge, and you pull them back. Whereas in the CIA program, they don't just take them to the edge. They push them way over.
And plus, in the CIA program, you are a prisoner. If you're in the military program, you're essentially all on the same team. But the idea is to sort of test your ability to endure these techniques.
That's correct, too, because anybody who goes through SEER training, they volunteer. I mean, it's required for certain jobs. If they do not volunteer, they can't take the position in special operations or some reconnaissance missions. But your point is well taken. And even the waterboarding, which the Navy school was the only one for many years to be using that, the individual, even if it was very, very difficult, excruciating experience, they knew that there were doctors, that they were in the presence of their colleagues. It would stop any time they wanted to it. Any of these pressures in SEER would be stopped as soon as somebody said, I don't want to do this anymore. So having those SEER pressures being applied by somebody who is literally your brother and sister in arms, as opposed to your enemy, it creates a completely different environment.
Well, to you, Scott Shane, and you have written about this. You've written about these two psychologists, and the question it sort of, I think, certainly nags at me, I think a lot of people, which is then how did what Colonel Kleinman just described as a training program, how did that get re-engineered, repurposed, if you will, into a program of torturing Al-Qaeda suspects Al-Qaeda suspects?
Well, James Mitchell, one of the two psychologists, has actually begun to talk a little bit. And, he had a theory that Al-Qaeda members were different from everybody else, and that they had some kind of diabolically clever training that would permit them to resist interrogation, and that while with the vast majority of other people, so-called rapport-building techniques, the usual kinds of techniques that police and military interrogators have used and the FBI have used for decades, that with these Al-Qaeda guys, you needed a different approach that only extreme pain and extreme force and distress would work. I should say that that Dr. Mitchell and his colleague Bruce Jessen, Dr. Jessen, did not have any experience with Al-Qaeda folks, and if you talked even back then in the 9/11 period, and even in the pre-9/11 period, to FBI agents who had in fact questioned Al-Qaeda suspects over the years, they would sharply disagree with that. At least those that I've talked to, and they would say that with ideologues like most Al-Qaeda folks, they actually want to talk to you about their beliefs and about what they've done and what they're going to do and so on. And one thing that gets overlooked sometimes as we discuss this torture that occurred now, most of it was more than 10 years ago. One of the remarkable things is that many terrorists have been caught by the United States since, and many have gone into the criminal justice system, and in just about every important case that I'm aware of, the person has talked a great deal. People like the underwear bomber who was arrested trying to blow up that plane over Detroit in 2009 on Christmas Day, he ended up talking a great deal. None of these guys were waterboarded. None of them had these coercive techniques applied. So, that's another reason to question whether it was, necessary and wise to use these techniques.
We're going to take a short break and then get back to our conversation. That's Scott Shane. He reports on national security for the New York Times and has been covering the report released last week by the Senate Intelligence Committee, where they documented the abusive treatment, even torture of Al-Qaeda suspects. Also with us, Colonel Stephen Kleinman, who has been an instructor with the Air Force Survival Evasion Resistance and Escape Training. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoena. A report released last week by the Senate Intelligence Committee detailed the work of two psychologists. They were paid more than $80 million to devise and carry out enhanced interrogations on Al-Qaeda suspects. Those techniques included things like waterboarding and other methods of sensory deprivation based on the psychological concept of learned helplessness. Our guests are Colonel Stephen Kleinman. He's a former military interrogator, former head of the Air Force's Strategic Interrogation Program, and Scott Shane. He reports on national security for the New York Times. We have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Any questions or comments for our guests? To you, Steve Kleinman, did you observe the things that we have learned from this report and from Scott Shane's reporting previously and other reporters as well? Did you ever observe any of this yourself?
Yes, not to the extent that we see outlined in the Senate report, but I was really shocked when I deployed to Iraq in 2003. I was then the Department of Defense Senior Intelligence Officer for Special Survival Training, which covers resistance to interrogation. And I thought my deployment was, or my particular deployment was because I had actually been an interrogator in previous conflicts. But very quickly found out that what was expected of me and the team that came with me was to teach interrogators how to use these SEER methods, these SEER techniques, in the course of interrogation, which to me just didn't make sense on its face. Because, again, as both an interrogator and somebody who's been teaching resistance, in the resistance course, we tell our students very clearly that these methods, these heavy-handed, these coercive models where physical, psychological, emotional stress is placed on a detainee for an extended period of time, the primary purpose of that, and that is, again, the Soviet show trials in North Korea, the Korean War in the hands of Chinese and the North Koreans, and in Vietnam in the hands of the North Vietnamese, it was very little about intelligence. It was primarily about compelling a detainee, a prisoner, to falsely confess to crimes, and then those false confessions could be used as propaganda. So on the information spectrum, a model that was perhaps the gold standard for getting people to falsely confess was now being used to get people to provide accurate, reliable, and comprehensive information. It doesn't, again, it just doesn't make sense.
Well, and I agree with that. And to you, Scott Shane, you have written a lot about this. And picking up on what Steve Kleiman just said, we're talking about an interrogation program that led to false confessions. As you described, two psychologists who didn't have any experience with interrogation itself. It sounds like very little knowledge of Al-Qaeda, perhaps even Islam. Looks like some of the people that worked for them were not well vetted. Was this a rogue operation? Who was overseeing it? Who green-lighted this thing? Do you know?
Well, you know, some of the details have still not come out. The whole program, of course, has been cloaked in secrecy from the beginning, and it sort of gradually leaked out this Senate report, which the summary of which, the 600-page summary of which has been released, is by far the most detailed look at the program. I assume that in the years to come we'll learn even more. But basically, it's clear that at the George W. Bush White House, the decision was made, they had to make a decision, that if we capture Al-Qaeda personnel, this is in the panicky months after, even weeks after 9/11, when everybody's worried about more attacks, if we catch these guys, we want to be able to question them about any possible coming attacks. And the thought was, you know, they were kind of casting about, and for a while they were actually looking at holding people on U.S. Military bases and getting the U.S. Bureau of Prisons to consult and help run the program for the CIA according to U.S. prison standards. That fell by the wayside very quickly, and they ended up using, obviously, very, very different methods. But part of the thinking there was that, you know, most of the interrogation experience in the U.S. government resided either in the FBI, which questioned people, obviously, for a criminal prosecution, and then with the military, which, of course, has always had a large interrogation element. But if you brought in the military, then they would be talking about the Geneva Convention and those kinds of rules, which certainly would have prohibited any kind of rough treatment. And if you brought in the FBI, then they're oriented to criminal justice system, to Miranda rights, and so on. And so I think it's fair to say that that President Bush and Vice President Cheney chose to give this to the CIA specifically to avoid those kinds of issues. The CIA really had very little experience in interrogation in recent years, and I think in a bit of a panic or a rush, cast about, sort of asked around and said, hey, who could question these Al-Qaeda guys, and happened to hit on these military psychologists. It's a decision that seems to have been made on the fly with very little study. One thing that I found even 5 years ago, questioning people at the CIA and the White House, the Bush White House, was that the people who approved this at the top of the CIA and in the White House approved specifically waterboarding, this sort of suffocation technique where you pour water over the mouth and nose of a person to give them the feeling of drowning. When that was approved by the White House and by the top of the CIA, the people involved, I was told, had no idea that waterboarding had been a notorious torture technique.
Really?
Going back for many centuries. Was used in the Spanish Inquisition, was used by Pol Pot, the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia. So they were adopting this method without having any idea of what its very gruesome past was. And I think that's indicative of the rush that they were in at the time.
Let me go back to you, Steve, only because you've been an interrogator. Based on your experience, does threats or even the kinds of things that we read about in this report, which are, pretty disturbing and taking away people's, ability to go to the bathroom, for instance, does that work under certain circumstances?
Well, to be fair and approach this objectively, will torture on a sporadic basis ultimately elicit useful information? And the answer is probably. Mm-hmm. But there's so many other questions that surround that. Number one, what are the strategic consequences of telling the world over and over again that we not only have senior officials, former senior officials, who say not only did we do it, but doing it again in a minute? And as Scott just he raised an excellent point, is if you look at the history, you put it in the context, these methods that they were using, quote, to interrogate. He mentioned waterboard specifically in the Spanish Inquisition and Pol Pot and others. How were they used? Were they used to try to compel somebody to provide useful information? No. Mm-hmm. In Pol Pot, it was, in fact, in most cases, it's either a religious or political indoctrination program. It was try to suppress heretics. It wasn't getting them to tell the truth. It's getting people to say what we want them to say. And that's where torture is very, very problematic. And here's the other point, too, talking about context. I hear so often when they say we need to use these techniques against, quote, those people, like Al-Qaeda, for instance. Okay, well, let's capture what they mean by these people. And the Al-Qaeda, they're talking about people who are fanatical. They are absolute blood loyalty to a very almost a religious type figure. We're talking about Osama bin Laden, the willingness to die in the cause. Well, have we ever dealt with that before? And the answer is absolutely. People need to look back at World War II when we interrogated very successfully Japanese prisoners of war who, with their tradition of Bushido, would never, in their minds, would never, ever cooperate. In fact, they'd never be captured. The same thing with the very, very hardened Nazis. But there was a program just about 10 miles south of Washington, D.C., that was classified up until 1990, where you had some very, very bright men, and unfortunately they were all men at that time, who questioned Germans and Japanese and used methods that absolutely were stringently consistent with any law of armed conflict, with any Geneva Convention guideline for dealing with people in detention. And George Frankel, one of those interrogators, who's now in his 90s, he captured it. He said, I got the information I needed through a battle of wits, and I never, never, ever put a hand on somebody. So I was able to accomplish my mission and retain my humanity. And I thought that captured it. And were they as difficult as Al-Qaeda? Absolutely. In fact, many of those people were far more educated, had far more life experience, knew far more about American culture so they could have counter-interrogation strategies. But we did that, and we did it in a way that we can be proud of, and it never came close to anything that would be coercive.
Scott, do you think this – I mean, can we call this a rogue program within the CIA, or did it have the sort of blessings of CIA leadership?
No, it absolutely had the blessings of CIA leadership. And one of the remarkable things that happened with the Senate report, and even before it came out because it's been awaited for a long time, is that three former CIA directors, three former deputy directors – one of the gentlemen who ran this program and others sort of banded together, realizing this Senate report was going to be extremely critical of them, and began a sort of counterattack. And they created a website, CISavedLives.com, and they have put op-ed articles in Wall Street Journal and a number of other places, and a lot of them have been on TV. I noticed last Sunday that on the Sunday sort of interview shows from Washington that defenders of these CIA methods, former CIA methods, I should say, actually outnumbered critics. The in some ways, the pushback was already overcoming the coverage of the Senate report itself. So not only was it approved at the time, but the folks who approved it are still defending it to this day.
We've got a lot of people that want to join our conversation. Let me begin with, it looks like Walter from West Philadelphia. Walter, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Go ahead. Thank you for having me on, and
yeah,
thank you for your guests' comments. My comment is that this report has been really laid on at the feet of these two psychologists, that the entire narrative is that this program was re-engineered and that the CIA and the U.S. government don't know how to torture people. But the School of the Americas, based at Fort Benning, Georgia, was a place where the CIA and the U.S. Army taught foreign military officers interrogation techniques from the 1950s up until the mid-2000s that included torture. And this program basically represents the insourcing of torture, where previously we used to outsource it to our client states throughout South America. Part of this program involved exporting people that we wanted to torture to states such as Syria and Egypt. We didn't talk about that that much, but to lay this at the feet of these two psychologists as if they had just re-engineered this entire program and that the U.S. Army and the CIA had no idea about how to torture people, when they had a program that taught torture up until the mid-90s, and maybe even now, we don't even know, but declassified documents show up until the mid-90s, that our government was teaching other governments how to torture people, and we were exporting our people that we wanted to interrogate to these torture farms, basically, to stop the quote-unquote Cold War communism spread throughout South America.
Well, Walter, you know, you make a really good point, and I want to take that point. We got, as I said, a lot of people that want to join us. And let me just give Steve Kleiman a chance to respond to that. You were a senior interrogator in Panama. Your thoughts?
Yeah. Well, I think Walter makes a very good point. I mean, even prior to the programs he was talking about, the CIA during the 50s and 60s ran a program under the code MK Ultra, which was an exploration of using all sorts of heinous means to get information from the benign, like hypnosis, to the truly unlawful, like using LSD. But one thing they found really quickly is using things like sensory deprivation, how quickly they could induce literally psychoses and hallucinations. But again, as an interrogator who understands the behavioral science, I've been working with behavioral scientists on this for over 10 years, I have to keep asking myself, okay, how does that impact the ability of the individual to recall accurately? I mean, we know research, for example, on eyewitness testimony and some others, similar type of memory-related research, how fragile our memories are. Our memories, according to psychologists, are more reconstruction than recall. And so using these torture back then or what Walter was describing, it just absolutely doesn't make sense, because it defeats the purpose of what an interrogation is all about, unless you want, your purpose of your interrogation is to get people to essentially falsely confess.
Walter, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Scott, we have an email for you from a different Scott. He says, who got the $80 million? Where did it come from? Has there been an accounting? Do you know the answer to that?
Yes. What happened was these two psychologists, Bruce Jessen and James Mitchell, they were involved from the very beginning of the program in early 2002, and for a while they were paid on a sort of daily rate as consultants to the CIA, and on the days when they were waterboarding, they were paid $1,800 a day, which the Senate report says was four times what the interrogators who were not waterboarding people were getting. Mm. But after that, in 2005, the program was continuing, and by the program I mean these secret jails overseas that the CIA was running for al-Qaeda suspects. And they formed a company called Mitchell, Jessen Associates, and then the CIA contracted with their company to essentially run the whole program. and they ran it until 2005, until it closed down in 2009. And that second phase, during those 4 years, their company was paid about $81 million. In addition, the CIA agreed to pay for essentially insurance to cover them against any kind of legal claims, and they have faced some, so that the CIA has paid, at least at the time the report was written, more than $1 million towards their the legal fees and that sort of thing. So, they did get a lot of money for their work.
And we're about a minute from our break. Scott, back to you. Did they do any of the interrogations themselves, James Mitchell, Bruce Jessen?
They did. Dr. Mitchell himself flew out to Thailand after they caught a guy named Abu Zubaydah, about the first sort of important guy the CIA caught after 9/11. And this would have been March 2002. He flew out to Thailand and oversaw and actually conducted waterboarding on this guy, Abu Zubaydah. And he subsequently was involved with the waterboarding of a guy named Nashiri, who was charged with blowing up a U.S. Navy ship in Yemen, and then with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the chief planner of the 9/11 attacks.
And that's Scott Shane. Again, he reports on national security for the New York Times. He's been reporting on the release last week, a report by the Senate Intelligence Committee detailing the work of these two psychologists that we have been talking about in this hour of Radio Times. They helped to set up an interrogation program that the Senate Intelligence Committee called Torture. And also with us, Colonel Stephen Kleinman. He's a former military interrogator and a former head of the Air Force's Strategic Interrogation Program. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, again talking with Scott Shane and Steve Kleinman. We're reacting to the Senate Intelligence Committee report released last week that detailed the work of two psychologists who were paid something like $81 million to devise a harsh interrogation program of al-Qaeda suspects. The techniques included waterboarding and sensory deprivation, wall slamming, based on a psychological concept known as learned helplessness. And again, we've got calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Steve, I'd like to read an email we have from Gary. It's long, but it's interesting. He says, as a Navy pilot assigned to a squadron in Vietnam, I went to Sears School in Little Creek, Virginia. One of the parts of the school was when you were captured and put in a POW camp. We were exposed to wall slamming, open-handed hard blows, confinement in below-grade, very tight locked bunks in the midday sun, and at night in the cold after being thrown into the muddy, quote-unquote, people pool. It was quite convincing. I disagreed with your guest who said that you learned how to endure these things. What I learned was not to get caught. But what he tells us here is just how extensive this SEER training program was. And just picking up on what you said earlier, when you're being trained is very different from how you might experience that, as tough as it is, than if you're a prisoner.
Well, it is extremely difficult, and it's designed to be, because otherwise we would... It would be a disservice to anybody like this gentleman who wrote in. It's hard to recreate the POW experience. It's certainly not in a week's time. But the point I think that's very important here is, and actually what he writes kind of is another insight into how we got to where we are. And that is, in the special operations world, pretty much everybody's gone through SEER training. And so when we were using the Army field manual on interrogation, which I have to point out is I'm not a supporter of it. It's never been, other than a paper I wrote with a couple of psychologists, it's never been subjected to any objective scrutiny in terms of its efficacy. It was failing miserably in the asymmetric environment of interrogating terrorists and insurgents. And so a lot of people said, well, you know, I remember when I went to SEER school, boy, that sure made me want to talk. And so sometimes special operations personnel would employ those same techniques that were used on them in SEER school without training, without safeguards, without overwatch. And the same thing happened. You know, we're making that argument today that it's not
that we try to say that it's an effective means of collecting intelligence. But again, that's not what it was designed to. It was designed to get people to ultimately create propaganda. And you know, when we talk about how much information we obtained through the CIA program, I think the information or the data is pretty clear that it was minimal. Hmm. It was absolutely minimal. And everything that was obtained through it could have been obtained in other ways.
Let me read an email to you, Scott, and another long one, but it's still interesting. This is an email from Roy. He says, as a psychologist and former member of the American Psychological Association, I'd like to raise a broader concern. Mitchell and Jessen were not merely two rogue psychologists who engaged in abhorrent acts. In fact, they themselves hired an undetermined number of additional psychologists to assist them with the interrogation in secret overseas prisons. But even more troubling, there have long been credible allegations of collusion by APA leaders with the CIA, the Pentagon, and the White House in efforts to reshape my profession. He's a psychologist. My profession's ethics code as to serve the sort of interests of promoting abuse and torture. There was an editorial actually in your paper today, Tortured by Psychologists and Doctors, raising questions about the role of some of these professional associations. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, since these techniques began to be leaked and publicly discussed probably about 2004, and also with information coming out of Guantanamo Bay Detention Center about some of the techniques used there early on, they're part of a very heated debate has taken place within the medical community, within the psychological community, about what the role is for professionals in programs like these. The CIA, for example, has over the years defended this program in part by saying that there were always medical professionals on site, and suggesting that their job was to make sure the prisoners who were being tortured did not die, did not suffer, permanent injury. But that is very much a two-edged sword. I think in the medical profession generally, to participate in a program that involved torture would be considered by most doctors to be highly unethical. And a similar debate has taken place among psychologists about, should they, of course, everybody wanted to help the country protect itself against terrorism after 9/11. And so a lot of these folks, volunteered or were enthusiastic about participating because they thought they were helping their country. But since then, there's been a years-long debate within the American Psychological Association and other professional groups about, what's the right conduct of a professional faced with an assignment like this.
Let me get, looks like Zeldine to join our conversation. Zeldine, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome.
I wanted to know if anybody's done any studies on the mindset of the people who actually did the torturing. What are they like afterwards? Does it affect their lives in any way? Has any study been made about these people?
That's an interesting question.
Or will it be?
Well, Zeldine, no, it's an interesting question. Steve, do you want to take that?
Yes, there are not enough, but there are studies out there that are looking into that because the lingering, the enduring effects, sometimes debilitating effects of people who have been involved with torture shows that sometimes certainly the emotional cost of somebody who commits torture is even more self-destructive than those who are on the receiving end of the torture. Even in SHEAR training, because, again, we would be involved with things that were very realistic, we would always be meeting with psychologists or psychology technicians in the military just to make sure that everybody was being able to handle the situation in an appropriate, healthy fashion. One of the most stressful things about being a prison guard is just the fact that they're constantly opposed to prisoners in detention, and the violence that goes on. So it is deep. And I know several interrogators who have admitted to me that at some point that they did go down that dark road and interrogate. And they said every day, there's not a day that goes by that they don't think about it. And there's not a day that goes by that they don't feel debilitated by that experience.
Steve, just a follow-up here. I'm just trying to think how difficult it must be, or maybe it isn't, I don't know, to set up an experiment to try to figure out what kind of interrogation works. Is that even feasible? Has anyone done that so that we can come to some kind of conclusion?
Thank you so much for asking that question.
Sure.
The second day in office, President Obama signed in an executive order that created what we call the high-value detainee interrogation group. It was designed to really address these issues where we have a higher standard for interrogation. And part of that, in fact, a major part of that, was for the first time since the 1950s, the United States government would actually invest in legitimate psychological research into methods of interrogation that were not only operational effective, but absolutely met the standards of human rights and of the law. In fact, all the research conducted by what we call the HIG, the High Value Detainee Interrogation Group, all the studies, and there's been 60 studies produced over the last 5 years at a cost of $12 million,
wow,
I might add, since we were willing to spend $180 million on torture. We've only spent $12 million on research. But it's all published in peer-reviewed journals. It's all unclassified. There's absolute transparency. Every study is approved by an institutional review board, so there's no stress. And what we find over and over again is that any point where there's controlling, where there's force, it actually inhibits a person's ability to recall, and it also stiffens their resistance. Whereas understanding somebody's goals, understanding their intentions, from negotiation theory, we could call it interests versus positions, we find over and over and over again, you get more and more accurate information.
Scott, going back to you, and I think you referenced this earlier, so based on your understanding of this report and your reporting, when was this, the harsh waterboarding torture part of the program, when did that end?
Well, it was sort of phased out, and the CIA referred to these methods as enhanced interrogation techniques, EITs, and I think officially they last used those in 2007, but by then it was greatly reduced. The last official use of waterboarding was in 2003, early 2003. And so the roughest treatment for prisoners really took place in 2002, 2003. But I should say that one of the mysteries that is raised by the Senate's investigation of this program is that there's some evidence that waterboarding was used more than on the three prisoners that the CIA has acknowledged. For example, they found a waterboard and buckets and associated equipment at a CIA interrogation site in Afghanistan where supposedly no waterboarding took place. And at least two Libyans have given fairly credible accounts to Human Rights Watch of being waterboarded when they were held by the CIA in Afghanistan. So, it's even with a 6,000-page report from the Senate, it appears that there are still corners of this program that have not been fully explored.
Steve, we have an email from Kathleen. I can't do the whole email, but I think her first point is an important one. She says, in addition to other ethical and theoretical problems, the idea of exploiting learned helplessness confounds me. I remember in college learning about learned helplessness, and perhaps I should have done this about an hour ago, but what are the how does that work, and what were the experiments used to create that condition?
Well, Martin Seligman did the original research in 1965.
In Philadelphia,
Right, and with dogs, where he would place dogs in a situation with electric shocks. They ultimately couldn't avoid it. No matter what option they chose, they couldn't avoid it, and ultimately they capitulate. And see, that's I appreciate, again, this question, because there's two things that you can obtain out of an interrogation. You can obtain compliance, or you can obtain cooperation. Compliance is such as what we saw in the report about somebody could snap their fingers and Abu Zubaydah would climb onto the waterboard.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that type of compliance is surprisingly not going to lead to useful information, because that individual is going to answer every question you ask, even if they don't have information in that particular area, because they're never going to say no. What we need in interrogation is cooperation, which allows virtual access to somebody's memory. And so it learned helplessness. And here's another thing, too. The learned helplessness model, this is not the first time we've seen it with interrogation. The Kubark manual that the CIA produced, I think it was in the 60s,
described it. And what they want to produce is a three-pronged outcome, and that is debility, dependency, and dread. Debility meaning to completely undermine somebody's psychological and physical wherewithal to resist. Dependency of the detainee upon the interrogator for bathroom use, for food, for sleep, for everything. And then dread, the idea that there's always this foreboding sense that if they don't cooperate, things are going to get even worse. But I would submit, and I know the literature in this area, and I've worked with a number of researchers, not just in America, but around the world in these topics. There's absolutely no data to even remotely suggest that that model would be useful in eliciting accurate information from an individual.
And this is a theme that we've been hearing during this hour. Scott, I sort of hate to raise this, but nonetheless, when you go through all the techniques that were used, there's a lot of focus on things like rectal feeding, denying people bathroom breaks, putting them in diapers. I mean, it is a sort of an incredibly sort of base and basic kind of treatment of someone. How do you understand that? Or do you?
Well, the only, I mean, it's a little
bit hard
to
put that to you, but it's, I mean, there it is. It's, yeah. You know, I'm looking at it right here.
Sure. Well, one factor in a lot of this, I think, that isn't explicitly addressed in the Senate report, but is there in the background, is that I think there was a lot of anger. I mean, let's face it, all Americans, you know, experienced a lot of anger as well as fear after 9/11. And here these guys had in their hands, meaning the interrogators, had in their hands some of the 9/11 folks who had actually done this, who had actually planned and helped carry out the 9/11 attacks in some cases. And if not, beyond that core group, there were people who shared the ideology, who were members of the group. And, I think it's hard to get away from the idea. Steve keeps talking about the difference between sort of inflicting pain on the one hand and ensuring compliance versus getting good information. And I think at times in this program it appears there was sort of a confusion of goals, and they lost track of the idea that the goal was to get the highest quality accurate information from these guys, and seemed to have used some methods to simply inflict pain and express their righteous anger at these guys, which is completely understandable. And I think the report does mention one of the few new things in terms of treatment of the prisoners that comes out of this report is so-called rectal hydration and rectal feeding. And that is somewhat ambiguous in the report. It's described as if it were a medical procedure that was imposed on people who were refusing to drink or refusing to eat. But the report also makes clear that this was given without any kind of medical orders or medical instructions. So it appears that this was yet another way to essentially torture these guys.
I hate to end on that note. My thanks to both of you. Scott Shane, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
Reports on national security for the New York Times. Steve Kleinman, thank you very much as well.
No, thank you for allowing me to be here.
Oh, absolutely. A former military interrogator. In fact, a former head of the Air Force's Strategic Interrogation Program. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out how to download podcasts of the show. Check us out on Facebook and Twitter, and also sign up for our newsletter. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne.